Hi, my name's Chris Owens. I played Jeffrey Spender on the X-Files, and I'm happy to be talking on the X-Cast.
Hello and welcome to the X-Cast. I'm your guest host, Darren Mooney, for a very special episode taking a look at Monsters of the Week, the new X-Files critical history by Zach Hanlon and Todd Vanderwerf, exploring the history of the show and sort of walking through episode-by-episode reviews of each of the 11 seasons and two feature films. And I'm thrilled to be joined to discuss this by the authors, Zach and Todd. How are you guys?
Good, good.
I'm quite well.
Perfect. The So just before we sort of jump into talking about the book, because I'm a huge fan, I suspect many of our listeners will also be huge fans of your work on The X-Files. You guys wrote at the AV Club covering most of the show's run, and then this sort of book is sort of like collects many of these reviews and expands upon them and includes elaborations and along with interviews and a variety of other sort of commentary on there. But before we jump in and talk about that, what we normally do when we have guests on the show for the first time is we ask them five questions about their experience of the X-Files and sort of to get a sense of their sort of read on the show and their sort of, you know, attitudes towards the show and their opinions on the show. And because your work is so kind of personal and so like tied up in all that stuff, I thought it might be interesting to ask you guys those five questions. So if we're ready to go, I might start.
Yeah,
sure.
Let's do it.
Okay, perfect. All right, let's jump on in there. Okay, so let's start with Zach then. And what I'll do is I'll ask each of the questions. I'll get Zach's answer and then Todd's answer as well. So the first question is, when did you discover the X-Files? So Zach, when did you discover the X-Files?
Well, I was there for the very start. I forget exactly, oh gosh, I should have looked that up beforehand. I forget exactly what age I was, but I would have been in high school. And I watched the first episode with my dad and my sister. It was on a Friday night. And it was kind of rare for us as a family to sit down and watch TV like that, especially on a Friday evening. But we all just sort of got into it. It's the sort of show where I can't specifically remember watching it and just like having a moment where it's like, I just sat up and go, wow. But I do remember liking it from the start. And we just sort of became like our family, kind of a family routine in our house. My mom never got into it because she was never really into like the sci-fi or creepy stuff. But I think we watched together. We must have watched the first two or three seasons. And I even remember watching one of the season finales at a friend's house because it was like kind of everybody I knew was sort of into it for at least for a while.
That's pretty incredible. And that was just for the first couple of seasons. And then after that, did you watch by yourself or did you sort of, was it like you left home and continued watching? Did it remain a sort of a family thing after that point?
I think it kind of fell out after a while. Like it's hard, especially with a show that runs that long and goes over, because eventually it switched to Sunday nights. I think we kept up with it for a little while after that. But I remember specifically, I kept watching it long after kind of my dad and my sister kind of went their separate ways. Well, I mean, with the show, they didn't actually get wet their separate ways. But I remember specifically, and I mentioned this in one of the reviews, watching the Field Where I Died and like watching the first 5-10 minutes of it and just deciding, nope, I am not interested in this, and just not really coming back for a while. And I would watch intermittently from then on. But by the time season 7, 8, 9 rolled around, it was very, very rare for me to sit down and watch them, especially when they aired. Which is one of the reasons it was so cool to go through and watch the review these for the AV Club with Todd and I, because it gave me an excuse to go back and actually finally watch some of the stuff that I'd missed, and some of it realizing that I was probably good to have not watched it, and some of it actually like really appreciating it and kind of falling back in love with the show.
Great, and actually, yeah, we'll talk maybe a bit about, like, because The Field Where I Died is one of the highlights of the book as well, the review that you wrote about and sort of the very personal perspective on that. But Todd, what about yourself? What about your experience? Were you a fan from the beginning?
I was not. So I grew up in an area where we didn't get the Fox television network at all. So like to watch stuff on Fox, I had to use our satellite dish to like pull in a signal from Denver, basically. So like I had to really want to watch something to watch it. So X-Files was not on my radar at all when it debuted. When I was in, I want to say, the eighth grade. This was around season two, season three, somewhere in there. This girl I knew and had a bit of a crush on was like, you need to watch this show, The X-Files. It's the best show on TV, hands down. And I was like, oh, okay. And then around this point was also when I was getting into The Simpsons. So I was like much better at pulling in the signal for the Fox network. So the first episode I watched was the Calusari, which is not like one of their greatest episodes. It's perfectly fine. I reviewed it in the book and thought it was, you know, thoroughly adequate. I watched that and was like, this is interesting. And then I kind of watched off and on over the course of however long it was into season three. And at that point I saw, I saw Jose Chung's From Outer Space, and that was the episode that made me a huge fan of the show, and it's still one of the best TV episodes I've ever seen. I always joke when I see Katie was her name. I always joke when I see her that she sort of gave me a career, and she did, because thinking about The X-Files was what started me thinking about television beyond just like a thing I turned on and looked at.
That's kind of interesting. I mean, I don't want to sort of jump ahead too much, because one of the great things about reading the reviews, and particularly in the book as well, is you guys talk about The X-Files and watching The X-Files as a process of like learning how television was made. I think, I don't know if it's Todd or Zach, one of you observed that like The X-Files was the first time that you learned to look at the writer credit on a show as well.
Yeah, I think that was me. I think I got to read the book itself. But yeah, I was obsessed with certain writers, and like when I saw it was a Vince Gilligan episode, I like paid more attention. And like that like manifested in weird ways too, where I like didn't like certain writers, and now I think they're perfectly fine. But like back in the, I don't know, back in the late 90s, I was very against like John Scheiben, and like he's a perfectly fine writer. But back then I was like, well, he's not Vince Gilligan, so.
It's a very high standard to hold any television writer to if you're not Vince Gilligan.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right. I think this sort of like dovetails into the second question, the five questions, which is, what is your favorite episode? Now, Todd, I think you may already have answered this, but we'll kind of come back around to that. But Zach, if you had to pick one episode of the show that's your favorite, what would it be?
It'd be Clyde Bruckman's, Clyde Bruckman's Final Repose. I got the title right, right? It's not Last Repose, right? Is it final?
It's final, final. It is final.
Yeah, I'm so sorry. No, I've answered that. I've said that multiple times. You know, it's if like I'm pretty sure that I was into the show before that episode aired, but I just remember being kind of stunned, like that way you get sometimes when you read a really good book or see a good movie, or when you watch. I think it's different with TV if it's a show that you've been watching for a while, because it blindsides you in a different way. Like, you've come to expect certain things from the show, like, you know, okay, I love these characters, and I'm going to be scared. And to watch something like this, which was at once entirely in the X-Files universe, and yet also had this different perspective on things, and just sort of so something so fundamentally bleak, and yet somehow humane, and just sad, and funny, and Peter Boyle's performance in it is marvelous. It's one of the best guest turns the show ever had. And just that experience, it just sort of stuck with me. I was very fortunate to get to review that episode when we were covering them, and that was one of the ones that I was very keen on getting to write about. And I had to rewrite the review a little bit because I don't think the first one lived up to it. But it was one of those episodes that I loved so much that I could never really write a review. It almost feels like I would instead of a review, I would just say, just go watch it. And yeah, there's nothing I can say after that episode ends. But yeah, that was the first one that I remember really just sort of being kind of astonished by, and just realizing how much potential and how much room the show had to go in different directions, and how many different things it could explore. So yeah,
that's a pretty good pick. Todd, what about yourself? What would be your own favorite?
I mean, I have to come back to Jose Chung's, but one of the arguments I make in the book is that I think it is a fantastic episode of television. I'm not sure it's a fantastic episode of The X-Files. I sort of argue for it as an appendix to the rest of the show. Like, if you were reading it as a book, this would be the first appendix where you got into all this like weird lore and minutia and stuff like that. But I love it. I think it's brilliant. I'm interested in the way that my opinions on its sort of its central idea have changed over the years, and I'm interested in how elastic it is in that regard. I was sort of talking about this with Darren Morgan, who's one of the people interviewed for the book, and he was like, you know, in the 90s, the idea that this, whatever happened during the alien abduction, if indeed it happened, was just written off as date rape was just like nobody really commented on it. And now there's like this whole conversation around it. And if you look at that episode, one of the things that makes it stand up is that like there's sort of this cruelty at the heart of it, that everybody believes it's more likely that this girl was abducted by aliens than that she was raped by a boy they all think is a nice guy, you know, like, and that has weirdly like stood up through the years. And I think that's part of the genius of that episode. But if I'm just picking, like, I always feel the need to like pick a scary episode too. And if I'm doing that, I'm probably picking Home from the fourth season, which just really reminded me of kind of the place I grew up with all these like weird foreboding places. With all of these like weird foreboding places that people lived in and like rarely came out and had signs that said trespassers will be shot on sight and things like that. So I love Home too, and I would put that at or near the top of my list.
All right. If you had to pick a favorite season, Zach, which one would you pick?
I think Todd's answer is going to be better at this than mine, just because I have a hard time thinking of the show in those terms. It sort of blurs together. But looking at the list, I would have to say it would probably be either season 3 or 4, because that felt like the time when the show was strongest, both in terms of its mythology episodes and its Monster of the Week episodes. And I think even though Bruckman is in season 3, I think I'd have to give the edge to season 4. Just because it has that brutal mix of like, let me just double check to make sure I'm getting this right, but that's the Scully's cancer season.
Yes, Momentum Array and stuff like that.
Yeah, and I love Never Again. It's one of my favorite episodes about their relationship. It has Paper Hearts. It has just so much good stuff in it, and Small Potatoes, and the field where I died, and Home. It feels very much like the show at its best was able to mix those, like, just sort of the intensity and forward momentum of the mythology episodes with really tight, cohesive Monster of the Week pieces. And not every Monster of the Week piece in that is great. Like, there are a couple of them that I didn't entirely love, but I just, overall, I think that's probably... It's a little arbitrary. If you ask me another year, I'll probably give you a different answer, but season 4 sticks out in my head.
Yeah, that is the quest. That's always the challenge when you're asked to pick your favorite season. Are you judging the season as a whole or as a collection of episodes? That's kind of almost harder to do now, I think, when you look at TV as sort of like a novelistic form. But what about yourself, Todd? What would be your favorite?
I always pick season 3. I will say that writing the book gave me a greater appreciation for season 4, which has always been like my second or third, but at times I would be like, yeah, well, this didn't quite work. Like, I think the Tunguska Terma two-parter kind of shows the mythology running out of steam, et cetera, et cetera. But rewatching it for the book, I found a lot in there to like really love. Season 3, though, just for me, is the one season where everything works. There are some fantastic Monster of the Week episodes. The mythology is still really clicking along in high gear. And it's the one season where you have an all-time great Vince Gilligan script and some all-time great Darren Morgan scripts. And those are sort of the two voices within the show that I think have stood out to fans over the years. So season 3 for me is just... outside of a couple, and actually, let me take that back. Season 3, even I think the bad episodes are more entertaining. Like, I would much rather watch the one with the killer cats than a lot of the show's bad episodes, because it's just like it's a fun bad episode as opposed to something like Sanguinarium from season 4, which is just sort of dreary and bloody for the sake of being dreary and bloody. So yeah, I think I'm always going to say season 3, and then my number 2 will probably change.
I'm half tempted to ask what your number 2 is. I know it's not the question, but I'm kind of curious now.
Well, no, I'd probably say more firmly season 4 now. There was a time when I would have said season 2. I think season 2 has a lot of great stuff in it, and I know people who really love that season. But season 2, to me, kind of lacks a couple of the things that season 3 and season 4 do at such a high level. And in particular, I think the way that season 3 and season 4 give Mulder and Scully kind of a personal stake in everything that's happening, season 2 lacks that a little bit. There are too many episodes where they're just sort of like shuttled around by the plot. And sometimes they're fun, but most of the time that gets kind of wearing.
All right. The 4th of the 5 questions then is, who is your favorite character? And it could be anybody. It could be Mulder, it could be Scully, it could be the Smoking Man, it could be Clyde Bruckman, it can be one of Darren Morgan's wonderful eccentric minor characters. So, Zach, if you had to pick a favorite character on the show, who would it be?
Oh, boy. I think I would like to say Scully, just because I feel like that reflects better on me as a person. But I think I'd probably have to go it's boring, but I'd have to go with Mulder just because Mulder is the character that I kind of connected with for the longest over the course of the show, and just watching him, like, I feel like he has, in general, I think he has one of the best, like, he has a really good arc over the run. I really loved what they did with him. While I had some issues with where Scully's story ended up by the end of the run in season 11, I thought the choices they made to make Mulder, especially in season 11, kind of older and grumpier and kind of confused that the world's left him behind, really worked in terms of my affection for the character. I guess I'd probably go with Mulder, with like a honorary secondary thing to Doggett. I had not actually seen any of Doggett's episodes, I don't think, before we did the reviews, and I really liked that character. I don't think he was given quite enough chance to really shine as much as, well, I mean, he's only in for a couple of seasons anyways, but I'm a big fan of Robert Patrick. I thought he brought a really interesting energy to the show, and I'm still really impressed that they managed to find a character who was... basically, he felt like he belonged in the X-Files world, but he wasn't a carbon copy of Scully or Mulder. And I suppose we could talk about this later, but they sort of try to invert the believer and skeptic thing in the later seasons when they bring in Doggett and Reyes. But I feel like Doggett stands by himself as being someone who is much less... He's sort of skeptical, but at the same time, it's more of like a common sense approach than like Scully's very scientific thing. And I don't know, I thought it worked very well. It was very impressive to me that they managed to create a character that was that interesting that late in the run.
Yeah, I am half tempted to steer the second half of this conversation towards the later seasons, because I think that some of the stuff you guys say about that is very, very interesting, and kind of the Doggett stuff might be a nice gateway to that. But before we do that, Todd, if you had to pick like your favorite character on the show, who would it be?
Scully. I'm glad that Zach said Mulder, because I was afraid we were going to have the same answer. I love Mulder. I am probably more of a Mulder in real life. Like, when my wife and I go on vacation, I frequently drag us to, like, haunted places to, like, just, like, I don't know, look for ghosts. And she enjoys it, so she's not my own Scully. But Scully, to me, has by far the more interesting story arc, which is not necessarily coming to believe, but coming to... understand that Mulder is not right, but like that she needs to support him through this. And like that has some connotations with the idea of how often we devalue the stories of women at the expense of the stories of men. But at the same time, I think that Scully gets to have her own arc. She gets to have her own personality. She sacrifices so much, and yet she sort of keeps on going. She's in some ways the most resilient character in the show. I feel like she gives up more than Mulder does. And she's also like super smart, you know, she's the one, I think the show, Frank Spotnitz talks about this a little bit in the book, but the show only works if the answers Scully gives for what happens are completely plausible, completely understandable, and in some ways more rational than Mulder's. And the show, you know, needs the monsters to be real most of the time for the horror to work, but you also need Scully to be, you know, presenting an answer that also makes sense. And I think that in many ways marks her as, she's a character defined by frustration in some ways. And I find that really interesting, fascinating way to go. And I think that really only happens because the show ran 11 seasons. Like, if it had run 5, I don't know that she would have been as marked by that. And I agree with Zach that the show sort of forgot how to write her, from roughly William's birth on, but, you know, Gillian Anderson was still fantastic in the 3 remaining seasons. But I don't blame her for saying she's done, because I can see why. You know, as far as like sort of a supporting player, I've always loved the cigarette smoking man. I get why they keep bringing him back, even though it's completely implausible. He's just such a banal evil, and yet he has sort of the ultimate evil. And I've been thinking about him a lot lately, and I wonder why. So
absolutely no relevance to the world that we live in whatsoever. Yeah,
exactly.
Okay. And if you had to pick, final question here, but Zach, if you had to pick a favorite moment from the entirety of the series, now it could be a long scene, it can be a short exchange, it can be a single line of dialogue. If you had to pick one moment from the entire run of the X-Files, what would it be? What would be your favorite?
I have a moment in mind, but I want to give it a caveat saying that this is almost certainly the wrong moment, if that makes sense.
There are no wrong answers.
Well,
in
the sense that ideally I would want a moment that was pure Mulder and Scully that captured all the show's ability to be scary and funny and sad at the same time, and really just, because their relationship is the foundation of the show, but the moment that came to mind when you initially posed that question is one that's actually just Mulder. I mean, Scully's involved tangentially, and it's something that happens very on early on in the series in an episode that I don't particularly like. I don't know what number it is, but since season one, the episode Conduit.
I think, yeah.
Yeah, it's generally, it's kind of a dull episode. It's still kind of, it's very clearly the writers sort of trying to figure out how can we just keep this about alien abductions all the time. And they hadn't really expanded outward into monsters yet, which they would do soon. It feels very kind of loose and very sort of staid and slowly paced, a very different show than what the X-Files would eventually become. But at the very end of it, it does a nice job of sort of reinforcing Mulder's relationship with his sister. And at the very end of the episode, while I don't know if the rest of the episode really earns that emotional attachment, the last scene is of Scully listening to tapes of Mulder in like hypnotherapy. And that shows Mulder sitting in a church of all places, and his voiceover talking about like he's just having this vision of his sister, or I can't remember the exact words, but it just ends with him saying like that this voice promising that he'll eventually see his sister again, everything will be all right. And the therapist says, "Do you believe that?" And he says, "I want to believe." And that to me just sort of, even just thinking about it, kind of gives me chills. And that to me just sort of encapsulates one of the things I love about the show, is that idea of believing in monsters not just as, oh no, these things are scary and going to kill us, and more as just believing in possibility, believing in the idea that belief in monsters is like a two-sided thing. It's like both, it's yes, everything, the world would be suddenly more terrifying, but it also means that there would be so much more things that could happen, so much more, like, and I find that very, it's not something that would come up a lot on the show, but I found that very moving, and it made me kind of connect with that character a lot more, and it's just one of the things that always stuck with me from the show.
And Todd, if you had to pick a favorite moment.
It's probably from my favorite episode, because it's the moment that hooked me on the show, is that closing monologue Jose Chung gives that sort of underlines all of the characters in such a short and pithy way. But also I think the idea at the end, where he says, "For though we may not be alone in the universe, in our own ways, on this world we are all alone," which I'm probably butchering the quote, it speaks to the heart of the show, which is in some ways about loneliness and about the desire for connection and about the desire for understanding and how hard that can be to find. And yeah, to me, that's just like the series in a nutshell. And it's a wonderful monologue, and I adore it.
Cool. I was actually going to like dovetail into talking about like the history of the project and your guys' sort of work at the AV Club reviews. We might do that in a moment, but it feels like the kind of you guys picking your favorite moment, Zach picking his favorite moment from Conduit, and Todd from Jose Chung's from Outer Space, it feels like it kind of dovetails neatly into like a question about what the X-Files was about for you guys. Like, what the X-Files, why it held such an interest. Because you guys wrote about, well, together and separately, you guys have written about all 11 seasons and have produced a book on it. That's a lot of commitment for, I mean, television reviewers, particularly television reviewers working at a remove from this as well. I know that you guys did it as part of the AV Club's classic TV coverage. But what is it that sort of drew you to the show and still presumably draws you to the show to the point where you would write and edit this book about it? Either of you, either of you wants to jump in.
Todd, you want to go first on this one?
Sure.
Gentle nudging. Or if either of you wants to step back, that's also a good option.
No. Well, I will tell you that one of the main reasons I started reviewing it for the AV Club was I was getting paid to do it. Toward this, when I started out, it was freelancing. And just the more pieces I could rack up, the bigger my check would be. So, but I had always loved the X-Files. And I like that was we sort of had it laying dormant in the archives. Keith Phipps, the editor of the AV Club for many years, had started it. He turned it over to Zach. They had sort of canceled it because I think the readership was not as robust as they'd hoped it would be. They had originally done it sort of in the build up to I Want to Believe, the second movie, and then the second movie was not the hit people sort of thought it might be. So the reviews were just sitting there, and then started getting more comments on them. We started getting people saying, "Oh, hey, do you want to, you know, do you want to revive the X-Files? And I was like, okay, sure. I'd love to do that. And I'll get paid to do that. Although for the amount of work we put into it, we were frequently reviewing, like toward the start there, we were reviewing three episodes a week plus doing like capsule reviews of Space Above and Beyond. Like,
yeah.
for the amount of work we put into it, it was probably not worth the, I think we got paid $50 a piece.
Yeah. It was very low at that point. Yeah. I remember that.
But you know, it was a show I loved, and going back into it just made me like love it even more. And I think what continues to draw me to the show is twofold. It's sort of that sense of, now it's threefold, I guess I should say. It's that sense of loneliness. It's that sense of an old America that's being paved over by modernization, by the internet, by things like that. Like the story of this show, as I think I read about in the home review in the book, the story of this show is Mulder and Scully come to a town. It has a little local legend. They expose the legend. Sometimes they capture it. Sometimes it escapes to haunt again. But like, this is a show about little local urban legends getting like paved over by much larger forces of modernization and the federal government and all of this. And like that obviously had a certain context in the 90s. But what I watch it for now is like this nascent sense of where we've headed since then, this idea that like there's always somebody out there to get you, that there are these overweening forces. And the people who worked on the show, if you talk to them now, are like a little leery of that. And that goes from Chris Carter all the way down. Like, they obviously don't believe that like the government is hiding like alien technology or whatever, but they definitely have this fear of like, did we create this world we live in now? And I think sort of Darren Morgan's answer to that question is like, a lot of the conspiracies today are not based on anything. They're just sort of based on the idea that I don't like this group and I feel like they're doing bad things, so I'm going to make up bad things they're doing. And say what you will about the conspiracies in the X-Files, but like something like Roswell, there's a reason UFO people are so interested in that. So I think that's kind of a fascinating dichotomy to watch the show through that lens in 2018. And I think that's one of the reasons season 11, to me, is so much better than seasons 9 and 10. It has that really strong central idea of, did the X-Files accidentally make the world a worse place? And like, it really wrestles with itself over that.
Yeah, that was a huge tone of, I think, like articles that were written. I believe you may also have written some of those articles, Todd, and I know Zach maybe covered it in the reviews at the AV Club as well. This argument, I think Ingu Kang did an excellent piece at Vulture about the idea of watching the X-Files through a modern lens and how sometimes that's very difficult. I know you guys would have obviously written these reviews, or written the reviews that maybe inspired you and provide the basis of some of the reviews in the book, like roundabout, as you pointed out, like 2008, 2009 into 2012. And obviously going back to write them for the book in the context of like 2016, 2017, 2018. What was that like? Were you looking at the show in a different light after that?
I'm trying to think if we sold the book before or after the 2016 election. I think it was slightly after, and that like colored a lot of everything that the show did in seasons 10 and 11. Not as much season 10, but it's certainly there, especially in the mythology episodes, which are messy, but try to sort of like deal with the idea of Alex Jones and all of this, and not quite as well as they might, but they're at least grappling with it. And then of course it definitely influenced season 11. So that's the thing about this show, and the thing that marks it to me as a great television show, is its meaning shifts with the times, and it's comfortably elastic enough to do that. Like, I think the piece you're referring to that Ingu wrote was sort of about Scully as a feminist landmark in the 90s, and now she feels a little bit less like that, and how that's happened and how that's changed and how the show has written her, and like, and yet it can still sort of stand up to both readings, and I find that fascinating. There are not a lot of TV shows that escape their era in the way that The X-Files has. And like, I honestly, we'd been talking about this 10 years ago, I would say it was sort of consigned to that era. But events have conspired to make me realize how much is within that show that continues to speak to us right now. Like, to my mind, that puts it on the level of something like a Twin Peaks or a Sopranos or something like that, where there's enough in it that it continues to reveal new sides of itself, you know, through time.
There are actually like reviews in the book as well. I'm thinking like of Shadows, which is a first season piece that you guys would have written from scratch for the book. And you touch on how some of the dynamics that were in play in the 90s, you wouldn't have thought much of. But I think in the present day, like the idea of this ghost of an authority figure haunting a young woman who he's taken a shine to becomes a lot more sinister in context. It's kind of fascinating how the show continues to give in that regard, I think.
Yeah, and that's a thing that we went back and forth with. Both of the editors we worked with on this project were women. Zach and I, you know, you can tell from hearing us. Was interesting because the two things about the show that I think in this age people are more sensitive to are sort of its depiction of race, which was always very well-meaning, but also always very clearly written by, like, white guys in sitting in a room. And its depiction of kind of, you'd say, gender politics issues. Things like sexual assault, rape, stuff like that, which was often used as, like, mere plot fodder. Sometimes in ways that were really compelling and interesting, and sometimes in ways that were not. And I think, like, one of the big reasons that the longest review I wrote for the book was Postmodern Prometheus is because I'm sort of wrestling with my love for that episode in light of the fact that it contains some really disturbing elements that a lot of people don't feel the episode thoroughly interrogates. I kind of do. And I won't get into it cause that would be like a 15-minute monologue, but it's certainly something worth grappling with. And I kind of like that about the show, but I know that Zach like had some reviews where he had that happen as well, maybe around different issues. So I'll throw it at him.
Oh yeah. I had, there was one in particular, well, actually the two of them stand out for me. I forget the title for one of them was about the creature that stole pigmentation.
Teleco.
Yeah, that one, I didn't particularly like the episode even at the time that I was reviewing it, but it was one of those frustrating attempts where I sort of tried to wrestle with it. And I'll be honest, I'm always a little bit nervous about doing stuff like that, not because I don't think it needs to be done or that it should definitely be addressed. I just am always unsure of my own ability to address it, and I'm always very worried about stepping on people or expressing myself in ways that turns out to be either misinterpreted or or just bad or just wrong. Because I don't really understand things because I grew up in a small town in Maine and I am a cisgendered white male. So, you know, you don't know everything. Nobody does, but you know even less than you thought you used to. And that was one that I tried to deal with a little bit more. Again, I don't really think I got into it as much, especially in an episode like that, which just isn't... I feel like if it had been a stronger episode, it might have been worth discussing a little bit more. But when an episode is weak for other reasons, it becomes much easier to sort of just say, yeah, this stuff is here, and it could have been used better, but it's just not a very good hour of television, so you just kind of have to move on. And the other big one that stuck out for me, I think there might have been more. There's like stuff here and there, like stuff in season 11 with the horrible reveal that apparently the cigarette-smoking man had impregnated Scully with science, alien science. Which is just no. The other one that really sticks out to me, especially in terms of working with an editor, was the episode Gender Bender, which just from the title alone raises certain warning flags. And I remember that was one of the first reviews of the show I ever wrote. I think it was either the second or third week after I took over for Keith. And I remember at the time really just enjoying it because it was one of the ones I remembered from as when I was a kid and just thinking it kind of captured the sort of weird vibe of the show and like lots of neat, like just eerie, cool stuff. And then when I revisited the review, I just sort of turned it down and sent it in as is. And then, one of our editors, I think it was Ashley. What's Ashley's last name? Do you remember?
Ashley Albert.
Ashley Albert, she very smartly pointed out, this raises some stuff, you need to talk about this, and I really appreciate the fact that she did. We had both of our editors, Ashley Albert and Emma Roberts?
Jacobs.
Oh my god, I'm sorry, I'm terrible at names. It's not a matter of disrespect, it's a matter of me just having a Swiss cheese brain. Pushed us both in several occasions, and with that episode in particular, I don't, again, it's not like I wasn't writing a thesis because I am not neither qualified nor capable of writing a thesis on those subjects, but at the very least, I tried to point out that I still think it's a pretty strong episode just in terms of structure and pacing. It's pretty engaging and weird, but it also, some of the things that it does are some of the things that sort of, to me, are kind of indicative of a lot of the show's sort of problems when it comes to issues like that, is that it's less consciously hurtful and more like people who didn't realize that they should have been taking these issues a little more seriously than they did. Or which is something that's very possible and easy to do, but it is also very necessary to point out, because those are things that are typically kind of that happen on TV all the time in every sort of art. So yeah, that was something that we sort of tried to wrestle with a bit more. And I won't say it's the most, I'm not going to say it's perfect, but I think we just, at the very least, we did try to engage with those topics as with as open and respectful mind as we could in those contexts.
And I think Zach brings up an interesting point, which is kind of in the editorial process, my editors were pushing back against the episode Bad Law, which involves the like Indian guy who can crawl up in people's butts.
The butt genie. that's what he's called, I think, by fandom, the butt genie.
And like they were sort of like, well, we need to deal with how this is racist and othering, and it is. But at the same time, the episode is so weird and stupid that I don't know that like you're going to come away from that being like drawing conclusions about Indian people or mystics or whatever from watching it. So like there is kind of like you have to control for the episode's ultimate thesis, the episode's ultimate message in a way. And granted, it's easy for me to say that as a white person, but like also I really hope nobody's drawing conclusions about Indian people from Bad Law, because like my God.
But yeah, this actually sort of brings up an interesting sort of question, because I was wondering about like how you guys designed to write the book and how you went about writing it, because it's structured in a way that it includes you guys obviously did like a lot of interviews, a lot of background material on it. It's structured episode by episode, and I'm wondering, did you guys settle on that approach sort of to go episode by episode, which always kind of evokes the reviews that some of the reviews you would have written for the AV Club. Did you ever consider alternate formats, like for example doing like a holistic thesis statement, or taking it season by season, or dealing with it theme by theme, or even just a collection of essays? Or was it always going to be like episode by episode, like a journey through the show from beginning to end, from the pilot to My Struggle 4?
I think it was always going to be episode by episode. There were conversations about it, but when Emma initially reached out to us, she reached out to Todd, and then they got in touch with me. It was very much, the idea was, you have all these reviews already on the AV Club. Why don't we find a way to put them in a different format and bring them to some different people and give you a chance to rework some of that stuff, a lot of which is a little rough. So I don't think we ever, and also because of the size of the show, once we realized that it was basically just going to be a process of taking these reviews, and bringing in, just like filling in the gaps where we'd missed stuff, or where, Todd had been away, or we hadn't, or Keith had started the project, so we had to do some of those early season reviews. Once we realized that it was going to be basically this massive project collecting all the reviews, it definitely kind of limited the sort of stuff that we could do otherwise. Todd did all those great interviews, and we were able to include those as like sidebars in the book. But because it's just so big, you can't. Once that became the main goal, it sort of took over and like kind of put aside any idea of doing any sort of broader thesis statements there's always going to be room for that kind of book as well. And it would be interesting to see how that book sort of book would turn out. But the idea was always, this was our pitch. These are we've done most of the work here. So why don't we just try and find a way to reshape it and make it more broadly approachable for a wider audience?
Yeah, I think, one thing I will say changed. They wanted, Abrams wanted it to fit in with the existing books they've already done, which are reviews of Mad Men by Matt Zoller-Seitz and reviews of Breaking Bad by Alan Sepinwall. And those two are collaborating on a book on The Sopranos, which will be out in January. And like one of the things, so they sort of wanted it to sit on a shelf with those. And one of the things that I think really changed was, originally we thought it was going to be about the length of those earlier books, which are both around 250 pages. And it is much, much longer than that. We'd kind of talked about like some of the lesser episodes just doing more as capsule-sized blurbs, and you can see some of that throughout. Some of the episodes are pretty, the reviews have become pretty short. But I am a notorious overwriter, so I feel like I kept driving the project longer and longer. But at the same time, like, we got so much great stuff from the interviews. We had, the show kept producing episodes. Like, it was a thing where the book eventually just had to be as long as it is. And, like, I'm really proud of it. I'm really proud that we fit as much as we did into those pages. And I think that, you know, if it had been 250 pages, maybe it would have been a quicker read, but I think it would have been a lesser book. I think it's legitimately a book you can sit down and like read. And that is a thing I never quite expected. And I'm really glad that they like sort of followed the way that it kept getting longer and longer. And if Zach and I ever work on another book again, we'll try and make it a little bit shorter for their sake.
Yeah.
I like that. The creative partnership is just sort of, it's just beginning. It's just being awesome. But I will say actually, Todd, just on that, it's, I actually think, having read the book, I read the book cover to cover this weekend, I think it holds together fantastically. And one of the things I really, really appreciated is that some of my favorite, and I don't, you know, we'll talk in particular about like the way that you wrote it and stuff like that, but some of my favorite like reviews in it are oddly enough like the longer reviews of less popular episodes, or the longer reviews of episodes that you guys don't necessarily love. So it's that you take the space to unpack, say, Nothing Important Happens Today, part one and part two, which you devote a considerable amount of space to, despite the fact you imagine that the temptation would be three paragraphs and we're done. And I as somebody who read the book and who really, really enjoyed it, I really appreciate that you took the time to do that.
And I went through and in the editing process, I read the whole book. We did a number of drafts, and most of the time I just like read my stuff because I, you know, it's a long project. But I went through and read the whole book for one of the times when we were kind of proofing it. And I was amazed at how well it held together, not just like as a collection of reviews, but as the two of us advancing an argument about the show. And like, I'm sure Zach and I would disagree on certain particulars, but it really does feel like we have sort of talked about, like, we sort of have found a way to advance an argument about the show's importance in the TV canon that, like, really works when you read the book as a whole.
That's actually a nice sort of jump into that, because I think it's in your introduction, Todd, you make this argument about like how we view television history, and in particular how we tend to have like particular landmarks in there. The two landmarks you mention are, I think, I Love Lucy from the 60s and The Sopranos, like, which obviously premiered in 1999 during the seventh season of The X-Files. And I think you sort of allude to the possibility that, like, there's a tendency to, like, view sort of like a hard and fast view of television history, which doesn't necessarily take into account the existence of, like, spectrums or shows that exist in long form in the way that, you know, they did during the 90s, and particularly The X-Files. And if you were making an argument for The X-Files as, like, as a piece of TV canon, how would you make that argument? I assume you do think that it belongs in the TV canon, but what is it about the show that sort of defines it, that makes it such an important piece of television history for you?
You know, for me, I think it's just, it stands kind of in the middle of all of these. If you want to look at TV history from a much higher point of view, it kind of stands in the middle of all these different movements. Like, you can point to it as, it's most easy to point to it as the child of Twin Peaks, but it's also the child of Moonlighting. It's the child of 70s cop shows. It has a lot in common with its contemporary Law and Order, which I think is the only time you would ever say that sentence. it's an interesting, like, example of TV between kind of the more episodic but still serialized stuff that aired in the 80s and the much more heavily serialized stuff that The Sopranos ushered in. And like, one of the problems with how we talk about TV is we often tend to talk about it in terms of like landmark tentpole shows that quote unquote changed everything. And The X-Files was surrounded by so many shows like that. Like, you have Twin Peaks, you have Sopranos, but you also have like The Simpsons and Seinfeld that were really changing things over in the comedy sphere. So it's a lot easier to sort of not look at it, because the children of The X-Files now are mostly CBS procedurals. They're like, you know, shows like Criminal Minds is very similar to The X-Files, but a much lesser show. Like, you don't see a ton of series in kind of the prestige space, and I'm using air quotes around that, that feel as influenced by it. But when you go back to it, like I said earlier, there's a lot more in there than you might expect. There's a lot more to like kind of dissect and figure out and think about than there is in something like Criminal Minds. And it doesn't feel cheap. It really does feel like it's going for telling this big sprawling story of like all of American history, but particularly American history post-World War II. So it's bigger on the inside than on the outside, and I think that that is always the mark of something great. And to me, that earns it a place in the canon. I know some people who would disagree, but I feel like it's an incredibly important show. And if you just want to look at it as, you know, kind of an example of TV changing, I think its experiments with serialization, while they were immediately like supplanted by other shows, were important and an interesting way of going. And like, I look at the way it balances standalones with myth arc episodes, and I think there are so many genre shows, especially on television, that could benefit from, like, you think about some of those Netflix Marvel shows, which are so bloated, how much they would benefit from an X-Files structure where they had like 5 episodes a season of the big story arc. And then, you know, the other 8 episodes are just cool standalone superhero of the week stuff. Like, bring it back, please.
What I was going to say, actually, because you're two fantastic television critics, and it's interesting that you mention like the discussion of the books that you're in with sort of like Seppenwall and Zoller's Eats, and particularly like Mad Men and The Sopranos and stuff like that, and particularly this book as an addition to that sort of canon. Can I ask you guys, like, as television writers and television sort of critics, do you think that like television criticism has come on a long way, or has been sort of more accepted or more mainstreamed in recent years? I'm thinking particularly of, say, the Pulitzer that was won recently by Emily Nussbaum, for example. But in terms of like the discourse and the fact that we're talking about television shows in the way that we are now, do you think that's a sort of a sea change in the past decade or so?
I think. Go ahead, Zach.
Oh, I was just gonna, yes. this is probably more Todd's belly look than mine. But yeah, I mean, just in terms of the fact that I have a job, we called them reviews for a while. I guess they're recaps now, but, when I initially started writing for the AV club, the TV club section, it was still a very new idea. There had been places like Television Without Pity that had obviously kind of pioneered that idea of these epic, long, moment by moment summaries and commentary. But that approach to television, still felt fairly new, just because it was something that I don't think you could have done in any other format. I think the internet kind of made it possible for us to start viewing television in a way that you couldn't necessarily do in like a newspaper or in a book, because it basically was like you would be reviewing the experience as it happened for people who were also watching it as it happened. And I think that sort of changed how we kind of view TV in terms of, and it sort of brought TV criticism up a level. It definitely feels, just from when, because I remember when I started, I felt very much like I was just trying to scrabble in and get a foot in the door at the AV Club, basically, because I'd been doing book reviews and I wanted to expand, and I didn't have access to going to screeners for movies, and I wasn't really a music reviewer, so TV just seemed like a very accessible thing. And I think the accessibility of TV, in terms of it's generally designed for a wide audience, and it's not, you it's good to have the canon knowledge, but it's also something that you can sort of go in fresh to, kind of made for a lot of people like me, in that you could have all these different voices, and as TV sort of expanded and sort of hit at the moment where gradually you started to have, and over the, especially in the past few years when there's so much more TV, you've seen coverage change again, like the recaps, the sort of recaps, recap culture has kind of been, it seems to have peaked and is sort of on the fading slide, but it definitely feels like we had changed the way we talked about television. In some ways, that conversation had some shortcomings in that I think the newness of it and the fact that it was so easy to get into it without having a vast history or experience of watching earlier television could often lead to people foregrounding modern, newer shows and saying, well, TV used to be crap, but now it's good. One of the things I appreciate a lot about are the critics who are constantly trying to mention a lot of this stuff has antecedents, and like TV wasn't always, it had a reputation for, I mean, some of the most famous criticism of television was basically how it was all bad, but here were a few things that were tolerable. And nowadays we're able to look back and appreciate things in different ways. I'm kind of rambling, but I guess my point is I do think there's been a change, and it's been kind of fascinating. And I think it's watching how that change has sort of affected how we view the canon and how that still is sort of a constantly mutating and changing thing over time, as it should be.
And you sort of referenced that there, the vast wasteland idea, I think is sort of what you're alluding to there, the idea that like television in the past was seen as being disposable and throwaway. I mean, we're talking about an X-Files book here, and you kind of, you mentioned books about like The Sopranos and Mad Men and stuff like that. Is there a process of like reclamation in there in terms of like as television critics? And you mentioned like the establishing of a canon. Are we doing that retroactively? Is there an argument to be made for like retroactively creating a television canon in terms of the medium? Sorry.
I mean, we've always been trying to create a television canon. Like before The Sopranos debuted, there were books you could buy that were like, these are the greatest TV shows of all time, et cetera, et cetera. And what's interesting is how like before The Sopranos debuted, the focus of greatest TV show of all time was so sitcom heavy. Like it was Mary Tyler Moore, it was I Love Lucy, it was Cheers, it was something like that. And those shows obviously are still in the conversation when people have that conversation about what is the best show ever made. But now it's so much more drama heavy, and increasingly it's more modern dramas, and I sort of get why that has happened, but I think we're also seeing a shift back to talking about TV outside of the lens of kind of the modern anti-hero drama. That's very exciting. And you mentioned Emily Nussbaum's Pulitzer win, and like she's somebody who's been very instrumental in driving that conversation forward. And like, I'm interested to see what happens next, because I feel like the anti-hero movement is run out of gas. Maybe somebody will reinvent it. It could always happen. But it's definitely like a situation where a lot of the most exciting work on TV right now is being done in comedies, but we're still sort of talking about these prestige dramas, many of which are like fundamentally empty. And I think that's sort of a fascinating world to be talking about old TV in. I do wonder, when we talk about establishing a canon, I do wonder, you know, what the market is for books about much older shows. Like, I do wonder, like, could you write I Love Lucy, The Complete Companion? I mean, clearly some people would buy it, but, like, how much, you know, how many of them would there be? And it could be even a more obscure show. Like, there's this show East Side, West Side, which is this great drama from the 50s that, like, nobody would buy a book about that except for, like, me. So, like, I do feel like one of the things that TV canon lacks is, you know, sort of a curation way, a sort of a curation Venn diagram intersection where, you know, there's one place everybody goes and you sort of know that this is going to be worthwhile. And the way that film has with like the Criterion Collection for sort of serious cinephiles and then Turner Classic Movies for more casual cinephiles, you just don't have that for TV. I think it's probably going to happen. It feels inevitable that somebody will start a streaming service for that, but we're not quite there yet.
Okay, just to sort of to drag us back to the X-Files, I think we're on the verge of wrapping up here. But one of the things that I found, it's kind of interesting when we talk about like television criticism, because I think it may be Zach in his intro talks about how at the AV Club, the editorial hand in the television writing was a little bit looser, and the writing was encouraged to be a bit more personal. And one of the things that I've really admired, because I would have been a big fan of those AV Club reviews, and I read the book, and I was very thrilled when I leafed through the book to find that a lot of the anecdotes and personal stories from you guys were still in there. I'm thinking specifically of like Todd's introduction to, for example, Postmodern Prometheus or Home, or I think it's Zach, as you mentioned, talking about The Field Where I Died. How did you balance that? Was there ever a sense when you were going to do a book adaptation that you might strip out the personal anecdotes, or were they always part of the conversation? Because I'm very glad they're there. I absolutely adore them, to be clear.
I will say for my part, I literally, because I was so terrified when they initially told us how big the book was going to be and how much of a problem that was, there was a period of time where I went through and I cut out every time I mentioned myself in like every review. I was very heavy-handed, and there are still some reviews in there that I look at now and I'm like, I think this is fine the way it came out. I don't think I shortchanged any great episode that I covered, but I do think in some places that the reviews came out a little shorter than they might ideally have been. But I think because of the nature of the criticism and because of the nature of going back, especially with TV Club Classic, is a lot of the times the way that format was introduced is one of the reasons I was so excited to be covering it and taking over for Keith. It was a show I had a personal connection with. And I don't know as I necessarily always felt entirely comfortable bringing myself into the conversation, as just for personal reasons, I would try, and it would always feel like sometimes it would feel a little forced and awkward on my end. But it did feel like, in order to be honest, I had to keep some of that in. Like, I couldn't just pretend that I was, like, speaking from on high, that some of my relationships to some of these episodes are very personal. And while I don't want to, like, let that completely overwhelm any sort of critical judgment, I do think it would have been dishonest to sort of leave that out completely.
Yeah, I cut myself out a lot. There were a lot of reviews where I just didn't, like, the episode didn't have a lot to say to me, so I just, like, did some weird story from my life. I definitely was in a place where, like, I have come around. I still love first-person criticism. I still think it has a place. But just in my job of trying to find new writers, both for the AV Club and now for Vox, I have come across so many people, especially, like, young white guys who write first-person criticism, and yet it's all just the same stuff. It's like a story about a time they fought with their dad or something. And, like, that's great, but a lot of the time it lacks the specificity to really make it matter, and to give it the specificity it needs, you almost have to ignore the thing you're criticizing. And, like, I find it's much easier to paint with broader strokes. One of the first person stories I kind of fought to keep in the book that ultimately got cut out was this story about I opened Jose Chung's with, which was about my earliest memory. It just didn't tie into the review as well as it needed to work. And, like, to make that happen would have required rewriting the review a lot more than I think I was comfortable with. And now I read that review and I'm like, this could be better. I probably should have just started from scratch for how much I love that episode. But, like, I tried to keep it when I thought it mattered. Like you mentioned, the home review, I cut it back, but it's still in there, this idea of, like, where I grew up influencing my viewing of that episode. And especially postmodern Prometheus, like, I think it's impossible to talk about why I love that episode without sort of grappling with, you know, the personal attachment I have, because if I don't do that, then I can just seem sort of like a callous jerk who doesn't understand why a lot of people don't like that episode, because I do, but also, like, I have this connection to it that I find hard to ignore. So when it was a thing that explained my reaction to an episode, I left it in, but a lot of the time it was just like, once I went on vacation, so I would cut that. You know.
Gotta hit that word count.
Yeah. Just to add a little bit, just because I think it's amusing, is that one of the things is a lot of these reviews, at least for my part, were written very early or very late on a Saturday morning with like an hour or two to get to deadlines.
Yeah.
And especially some of those later curated episodes where there's not a lot going on, and I literally could have just said, oh, by the way, this is another unfinished premise, and I would just vamp for time because you just want to make sure you... It's not the best way to write reviews, but I think it's also part of that experience of reading the AV Club stuff at that time, because it was sort of a journal. It was better formed than a journal of the experience would have been, but it also had that sort of feeling of that sort of raw feeling of the, you're coming into my head for a little bit, and this is what I'm thinking of at the time, so it sort of worked. But it was one of those things we definitely kept in mind while we were writing the book.
And, you know, one of the things I wanted, this is just a quick aside, like, the most fateful thing that ever happened to me was when I came on board at the AV Club. Keith was like, you know, we try not to go over 1,200 words, and I heard it as be under 1,200 words. So, like, the fact that now everything I write is at least 500 words too long is, like, it's all his fault. So,
just quickly, I was reading the book, and I had some sort of, like, questions about the process, and feel free to tell me this is, like, a, you know, you guys work under your own mechanism, and you've got no interest in answering these questions, but I was kind of curious about how you guys divvied up the reviews. Now, I know, obviously, the stuff you wrote at the AV Club, you took a lot of the reviews that you wrote then and them down, but in terms of stuff like, for example, say, the first season, where a lot of that was covered by Keith Phipps, how did you divvy up the episodes there, or the final seasons, where, you know, Todd wasn't working at the AV Club, so Zach had written all the reviews. How did you decide which ones Todd covered there? Did you sort of flip for them? Did you make a case for them? Or did it just happen naturally that your interest sort of lay with what you got?
I know with season 10 and 11, I think season 10 I specifically, because I actually did, I reviewed both of those entirely for the AV Club, and I know with season 10 there was like one of those reviews that I specifically wanted. Because I get to review that Darren Morgan episode that season, and I was like, I really liked how this turned out, so I would really like to keep that. Whereas the season 11, Todd said specifically he really wanted to write about the Darren Morgan episode. So my review still exists at the AV Club, but Todd's is the one in the book and it's very good. no, but I think I forget Did we even divvy those up before the season even aired?
Yeah, we did. We did. Sort of what happened was we had done, he had done the, Zach had done the odds and I had done the evens in season 10. And I was like, this is just, if we just keep doing this, then, you know, I'll get the other Darren Morgan episode. Because we initially, when we had done the first four Darren Morgan episodes, it worked out that we each got two of them. So that, that kind of like ended up being a neat way to continue with that idea. But then Zach also got the one about the drones hunting Mulder and Scully, which I wish I had gotten to write about. So
yes, I was very happy about that one. That was a great episode to write about.
But I also got to write about this, which I think is a hugely underrated episode. I think it's a very good episode of the show. So it just sort of the odds, and it just sort of ended up being odds and evens. And I think in season one it was like we just kind of pointed to certain episodes. In general, if it was like a mythology episode, I ended up writing about it more often than not, just because that was, I feel like I had stronger feelings about that.
Yes,
but
that's very just,
true. In season one and then the first half of season two, it just kind of often ended up being that you know, we took an even split, but it was like certain ones that we felt more passionate about or whatever. There was never like a lottery or a draft or anything like that.
No fisticuffs at dawn. quick one though. Just finally before we wrap up, because one of the interesting things, and it's a tension within the show, and you discuss it as a tension within the book itself. And the title of the book is Monster of the Week, which is a great title. And obviously everybody's familiar with like the connotations of what it means and stuff like that. One of the interesting things about the book is how you approach the mythology episodes. Sometimes you lump two-parters together. So, for example, I'm thinking the Blessing Wayne paperclip, and I think you do Tunguska and Terma together. And sometimes you do them separately, like Nicaea and 731, I think you do separately, for example. And I was wondering, how do you guys... Well, first of all, what do you think of the split between the mythology and the Monster of the Week episodes? And second of all, was there a sort of a logic behind the mythology episodes that you treated as two one-parters as compared to like a two-parter holistically?
I think that the two-parter thing was sort of an editorial push just to save space. And I do think, I think Todd was the one who kind of said, okay, I think we can do these as two-parters. I think it was more when there was a mythology episode that was like an episode that really strongly stood out with its own identity. We tried to keep that on its own, but it was when it was ones like a two-parter that sort of pushed together, either they were a little bit weaker or else they just, that the story flowed along so well that it just made sense to put them together in a single review. We kind of clumped those together because some of those reviews were ones that we'd written separately and then we had to sort of edit together into one big whole. And in terms of the Monsters of the Week mythology split, I do think, and Todd mentioned this earlier, I think it's one of the X-Files, kind of its most undersung, but one of its most important contributions to the way sort of TV serialization developed over time is that idea of, I think it was the actual structural concept of that split was pretty brilliant. It could sometimes lead to situations where you were wondering why Mulder and Scully weren't talking about the potential end of the world threat that was hovering over their shoulder while they chased down, you know, a bog monster in New Orleans or something. That's not an episode. I just made that up. But
that'd be great.
Yeah, it would be, wouldn't it? But I don't know. Is it over time? It's kind of a cliche, but the Monster of the Week episodes remain strong in that. And I think this is something I tried to talk about in the book, in that with a Monster of the Week episode, if it's a bad one, it doesn't indict the rest of the Monster of the Week episodes. Whereas with the mythology episodes, if you have a bad one, or if you have a couple of weaker episodes in a row, because they're all connected together, it starts to drag down the whole thing. So I think just by the nature of the structure, you end up kind of appreciating the Monster of the Week episodes a little bit more. But yeah, go for it, Todd.
Yeah, you know, it ended up being like... if it was a two-parter that we had already written about, a lot of the time, those AV Club reviews, we wrote about the two-parter in one piece. So, like, you mentioned the first two episodes of season three. That was, like, I had already written that, and I just had to, like, I just had to edit it down, basically. Or the opener of season seven or something like that. Those were often just things I had already written and had to edit down. What was trickier was collapsing when we would split up those two-parters, was collapsing them into one. And a lot of that happened because for seasons 4, 5, and 6, we were reviewing the X-Files and Millennium. So we were doing one X-Files a week and one Millennium. And that, you know, ended up leading to a lot of those having to be collapsed. And so that was a little more involved, but it wasn't too bad because a lot of the times we had the same thoughts about them. There were only a few times that I feel like Zach and my thoughts were wildly divergent, and often you could just sort of be like, well, in this episode, this happens. So as far as like the split between the Monster of the Week and the mythology, I certainly sort of subscribe to the conventional wisdom that Monster of the Week episodes have held up better through time than the mythology, but I definitely feel like the mythology is now slightly underrated. Like we've done some interviews with more X-Files specific sites, and they kind of have had this fear that we're not going to talk about the mythology at all in the book, and because of the title, and like obviously we do, it's covered throughout. But the thing that I think has gotten a little overstated about the mythology is that it's impossible to understand, when actually the through line of it is pretty clear. It's just like there's so much stuff going on that can be easy to ignore. And actually, the original series finale, like, lays out exactly what happened. It's just like an excruciating slog of a television episode. So getting through it and hearing about it is tough. But the other thing, I guess I would say, is that when those episodes were good, they were so propulsive and so tied in to like the characters that it was really hard to ignore like how exciting they could be. So yes, the mythology fell off a bit, but I feel like saying, you know, well, ultimately it doesn't come together is sort of true, but also negates what made those episodes so good, especially in the first three or four seasons.
Cool. I think that about wraps us up, but thank you very much, guys, for taking the time to do this. If people are looking to buy Monster of the Week, where is it? Well, it's available everywhere online, but do you have anywhere in particular you'd like to point people towards?
Oh boy, you know, I don't offhand. The Abrams Books website, if you look at my Twitter profile, I have a link to buy it on the Abrams Books website, and they link to all the places you can get it if you don't want to support Amazon, which a lot of people don't. Like, there are other ways you can buy it. I would say if you can get it at your local bookstore, I travel a lot, and when I travel, I've been trying to sign copies of the books. It doesn't always work out. I went to the Strand the other night, and Lin-Manuel Miranda was already there signing books, and he took priority over me for some reason. So it doesn't always work out, but when I can, I do. If you happen to be in Los Angeles, go to the Last Bookstore. I'm going to try and drop by there and do some signing of their stock so you can have that. But yeah, I if you can, buy it from your local bookstore, but if not, it's available everywhere online, and you can go to Abrams Books and they have links to all of the different sites you can buy it from.
All right, well, thank you very much, guys, for your time. This has been an absolute pleasure. Good luck with the book, as they say, I think, in Father Ted of all things. Take it easy. In the meantime, the X-Cast will be back next week covering Talitha Kumi. Until then, trust no one.
The X-Cast and X-Files podcast is produced and presented by Tony Black, alongside a dedicated group of podcasters and X-Files fans. You can find us on Twitter at The X-Cast, and on Facebook if you type in The X-Cast, or at our group X-Files Basement, an X-Cast podcast fan group, where you can continue the discussion about all things Mulder and Scully. If you want to support The X-Cast further, you can now subscribe and become a patron of the show on Patreon. On Google, just type patreon.com/thexcast. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N. You'll see all of our tiers, subscription options and perks, which include early access to episodes, bonus content such as commentaries on X-Files episodes, access to a patron chat zone, and even appearing on one of our patron roundtable discussions. We would appreciate any support you can give the show, so just go to patreon.com/thexcast to find out more. Our title music is provided courtesy of Will A, who you can find on Twitter at I am Will A Y E.